Well, get ready for this coast-to-coast ride tonight. Dr. Carmen Bolter is a professor at the University of Calgary, teaching in the Graduate Division of Educational Research. Now, Carmen has been to at least 51 different countries in search of clues to lost cultures from a golden age. Her quest has brought her to Egypt 23 times, where she has done extensive academic research and field work in the pyramid fields around the Great Pyramid. Here she is on Coast to Coast, back again. Carmen, how are you?
I'm great. Hi, George.
Good. I don't know if I told you the last time we were talking, my father was born in Cairo. I don't know if you knew that or not. Did I tell you? Okay, good. And he left there when he was 6 years old and came to the United States with his family and does not remember anything about the pyramids, just has a picture of him walking around some old ancient buildings and things like that. But that would have been something, huh?
Uh-huh.
My gosh. Well, what's new with you since we talked?
Well, after telling you on the last show that I thought I was done with Egypt, I got an email actually from Richard Hoagland who said, "You are so not done. We have to talk." And I ended up going back just a couple of weeks ago here. And I was really surprised at how many changes there were. But one of the things that brought me there was the press conference with Dr. Zahi Hawass on February 17th talking about the DNA testing with King Tut.
Update us on that.
Well, I stood there at the press conference. I predicted that he would try to say that Tut's father was Akhenaten, though there's quite a bit of controversy with that, and I'm, you know, a little bit confused with why he's trying to make that link. Now, I subscribe to the notion of psychic archaeology, and I've got some very strong feelings and reasons why I don't think that's the lineage. And when they did the DNA testing, basically what they're looking at is a medical model, which I find confusing because they're saying that he had crooked toes, a club foot, a cleft palate, and he died of malaria. And I'm like, why all the medical influence? And when they did the DNA testing supposedly on Hatshepsut, they said she was obese. And, of course, they were always insisting that Akhenaten is sick, deformed, crazy. Well, when I think of these wonderful beings from the 18th dynasty, I think of them as highly conscious beings, super gorgeous, very healthy, far healthier than us. And so I'm not exactly sure how all that adds up. Now, if you go online, there's some videos that are showing how they did the DNA testing. And you'll see that they use the Y chromosome. And I'd like to explain about mitochondrial DNA. But in any case, they're referring to the mummy of Akhenaten while they're showing a skeleton, and then the very next video starts, and it says, well, we don't really know who Akhenaten is. So there's so much contradictory information. The other thing that they stood up and said was that they only started doing the DNA testing, and it was going to take them another 2 years to finish.
2 years?
Well, the thing is, I've been waiting for this data for 12 years.
Yeah.
So it started out with a Japanese team, and they were just about to collect the DNA, and they were shut down in terms of security. And then Scott Woodward out of Utah at Brigham Young University was given the rights to do it, and he had a team with him from National Geographic, and they were just about to drill into the tooth to get the DNA, and they were shut down, and the whole crew had to go home. And I was scheduled to go to Denver to listen to the results, and he stood up and said, sorry, or wasn't allowed to take the test. So then they got a DNA lab and put it in the basement of the National Museum, and then we've been waiting for another 5 years. So I was pretty excited about this data coming out, yet I suspected that they weren't going to say too much.
Now, is it your impression, though, Carmen, that Zahi has an agenda?
Well, exactly. You see, I said to a few people, I'm going to go to this press conference when I found out it was happening. I brought a group with me that didn't start till the next day. And I said to people, I predict that he's going to try to say that Akhenaten's the father, but I'm sure they're not going to find Akhenaten and Nefertiti's bodies for two different reasons. But still, it's an agenda. But also, like, I teach quantitative research methods, so I understand, you know, how you have to have validity and reliability and make sure you're measuring what you think you're measuring and not just keep coming out with different diseases instead of the lineage. Now, when they said that they were using the Y chromosome to do the testing, I really think there's a problem with that because mitochondrial DNA goes through the matrilineal line. And the Egyptians knew this, which is why the pharaoh would marry the daughter of the pharaoh before him to keep the dynasties within the family line.
How would they know this at that point?
Well, let me mitochondrial DNA. If we were to take my son, me, and my father, and you,
all right,
measure all our DNA, we would know that you're in a different gene pool than we are, that I'm in the middle, my son is younger, and my dad is older, because it's almost like tree rings. You can count the generations.
And would you know, though, that the three of you were somewhat close intact, and I was on the outskirts here?
Absolutely. That's
okay.
The point. That's the point. And that's why when you see the matrilineal line, that the Egyptians were, well, there's a lot of things they knew that we're just barely starting to grasp, but they absolutely knew this. So the matrilineal line is the XX. So if they're testing the Y chromosome, again, that just can't be the answer.
And what's so the significance, though, Carmen, of the fact that he's trying to position Tut as being a descendant from Akhenaten? So what? What's
well, exactly.
He trying to prove?
Well, so what? Exactly. But the thing is that he's missing the sociocultural context, as we talked about in the last show. What was going on at the time? How is the Amun priesthood out of control? How does it parallel things that are going on now? And because there was also a problem with the DNA, there weren't a lot of boy babies being born at the time. Akhenaten and Nefertiti had 6 girl babies, okay?
Interesting.
And in Hatshepsut's time, there weren't a lot of boys either. And so there was something, I think, a genetic disturbance or something like that. And who knows why, but if you read books on Amarna, they're like, well, just because they didn't show any boys in their family images and showing them all quite, doesn't mean he didn't have a boy. So it's almost like this patriarchal imperative, almost, you know, in China, they want them to, you know, have boy babies or
there's just,
it's still patriarchal ways of being and thinking. I'm not sure why that's the agenda, but it's almost like Zahi also thinks that he's going to retire when he finds the mummy of Cheops inside the Great Pyramid. Well, the likelihood of that is about zero. Everybody in the pyramid code that's interviewed basically says the pyramids weren't tombs. They found a statue at a site, you know, there's 3 sites between Saqqara and Giza, and they found a 2-inch statue of Cheops, and that's all they go on to prove, quote-unquote, that Cheops built the Great Pyramid. And if you look at the photos that Lex just posted on your website.
Yep, and people, just refresh your browser in case you have to. Go ahead, Carmen.
And what you'll see is that they're excavating inside the Great Pyramid. I was in there like 3 weeks ago. There are 2 enormous extension ladders at the top of the Grand Gallery, just in front of the entrance to the King's Chamber.
What are they excavating into?
Well, there's wires going up in there, which means there's electricity. And a couple of years ago, I saw a lot of burlap sacks full of powder, which means they're drilling. There's power lines going up into the Davidson chambers. There's an extra passage in the pit and the subterranean chamber that's on film in the pyramid code. And I think they're just drilling through solid stone, thinking the mummy's
hoping,
in there somewhere.
Hoping they're going to run into some...
Hoping they're going to run into the mummy.
Something.
That's what it looks like on the surface. It's top secret. We're never going to get the real agenda. But I also think they're barking up the wrong tree.
They have had to have done some testing that has got to show something in there, don't you think? With some kind of ultrasound or whatever they might have.
Well, look at the picture of the ladder that's tied together with rope. I mean, I think that we lose touch with how primitive things are in modern Egypt.
Yeah, no, I know.
And even when they did the ground-penetrating radar, when Robert Schock and John Anthony West, they were using a sledgehammer and a device that basically was measuring. It was quite rudimentary, but also there's a honeycomb of passageways underneath the pyramids. So it could be anything.
Well, it could be he's looking for a needle in a haystack if he's doing
it this way. Definitely. To me, it's a needle in a haystack, but it's missing the whole point of who the ancients were and what they thought, what their cosmology and what they understood about biology and the cosmos. They were incredibly sophisticated, and so to narrow them down to medical conditions, I think it's not fair.
No, it's not. And how technologically advanced, Carmen, do you think they were?
Well, there's a picture also up on the website there where I'm looking at, I'm showing you the Pleiades, the Belt of Orion, and Sirius, and how they line up along the celestial Nile. And the old riverbed used to run right there, and I've pointed, I didn't superimpose it on a map of the pyramids, but it does line up with the Giza pyramids, the Great Pyramid, the Second Pyramid, and the Third Pyramid, the Abu Sir, which is connected to the Pleiades, and Abu Roush to the north of the Giza Plateau, which is connected to Sirius. And the whole configuration aligned with the Milky Way, which used to parallel where the Nile was. Now it's migrated 8 miles to the east. This configuration, if you go into Starry Night Pro, follows back and forth and all the way around. I ran it up to 40,000 B.C., and up to 20,000 AD, and this configuration holds strong all the way through. But what's happening with 2012 is the whole thing is lining up with the center of the galaxy. Now, when I saw it in Starry Night, you know, my heart skipped a beat, and I'm like, oh, it's obvious. Of course they knew. But how? They were pretty darn sophisticated. They understood string theory. They understood this mitochondrial DNA. They were very sophisticated in terms of their star-sky-ground correlation, you know, and what they were mapping in the most durable of stonework for us to see now and go, oh, and everything we've been looking at about them before, we haven't understood. And so, you know, we've infantilized them and made them obsessed with death and animals and stuff like that because we don't know how to position them in terms of the extreme sophistication of their consciousness, of their energy, of their ability to move between dimensional spheres. It's incredible.
Tell me about your thoughts of Abydos. You know, I constantly think of that tablet that looks like, to me, craft, flying craft, submarines, a ship. You know the one I'm talking about?
Oh, definitely. The most interesting thing about that lintel is that it was covered for the bulk of ancient Egypt, or the dynastic Egypt, which started parallel to the Mayan calendar, 3113 BC and 2012. But so dynastic Egypt was already patriarchal, and it was already deteriorated from the high, high level of technology and that sort of thing. But there was a piece of stone covering that. And 20 years or so ago, it just fell right off, and then that was what was underneath. And there's been a lot of double-stepping to double-talk to try to explain it away in terms of hieroglyphic, but you're not going to find that. And there's a lot of anomalies in the hieroglyphs as well that are telling a different story. And so I think that this that it's extremely old. Now, if you look at Abydos at the Osirian, it is 30 feet below the Temple to Seti. Now, I think at certain times in the New Kingdom, particularly in the 18th dynasty and in the reign of Seti I in the 19th dynasty, they were remembering times past and bringing into their consciousness a higher level. That doesn't mean that everyone was in that level, but they were remembering information from a golden age. Now, one of the things that particularly absolutely flabbergasted me this time, because I've been to Abydos several times, when we went out back to go into the Osirian, it's usually full of water. And for the first time ever, George, I saw that the water level was such that you could actually go in and walk on the floor. So, of course, it was barricaded off. And I went walking up to the stairs where you look down and you can see where the flower of life, there were two flowers of life that you could see between the pillars. And there's been a lot that's been, a big deal's been made out of that. So the watchman came up to me and looked me right in the eye and said, "Do you want to go down there?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Okay, 2 minutes." So I went down there with my camera and walked on the floor in the Osirian. Now, deeper is always older. So if you look at photographs of the stone, the megalithic stones of the Osirian are like the Valley Temple, and they're like Stonehenge. And there's a water table underneath all of them because the magnetic resonance that works with the temples works with the big stones, the granite structure, and the water. And so this used to be, in the ancient of ancient times, the place where people gathered at special times, solstice, equinox, that sort of thing.
I was going to say it somehow echoes some of the thoughts of the Mayans.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And then later, smaller construction, higher construction, which gives you just some indication in geological time how much older the Assyrian is. And so when I walked on the floor, of course, I went straight to see where the flowers of life are. And usually there's a shadow from the sun that will block off any other view. And I went down there. And it's not that easy to see them. They're a little bit pale because of the light, and it's in a shadow. But there were 8 flowers of life on one pillar where we used to only see 2. And I turned around, and there were 10 more on the other side. 18 flowers of life in the Assyrian. I don't think you've ever heard that, have you?
No.
And
no,
the photographs are up on your site right now.
You know, I had Zahi on about a year ago, Carmen. I talked to him about Abydos, and I want to talk to you about those objects for a few minutes before the break. And he talked like he didn't even know what I was talking about. I got to believe he knows what this whole area is like.
Well,
it doesn't make any sense.
Well, there's a lot that doesn't make sense. It's hard for us to understand. Like Andrew Collins, you know, has YouTube images of inside the network of passageways underneath the plateau. Zahi completely ignores it and says it's not there. So he definitely is focused on what he's focused on. We've all seen that anything that's outside that realm, he can't compute it, doesn't want to compute it, it doesn't exist.
Do those images that to me look like flying craft, submarines, boats, do they look like that to you too?
Yes. Yes. Now, what they are, whether they're future pacing or they were, you know, reaching into what we were going to have, or if they had that sort of thing in the distant past, who knows? But there's no way that they're superimposed hieroglyphic that make the impression of that sort of thing. The other thing is they're like 30 feet up. And so when you're looking at them, they look a couple of inches high.
Yeah.
It's difficult to make them out. And we've got some higher resolution pictures now, and we can look at them. And they're flying craft. They are. They look like that.
Oh, my God. Something happened a long time ago.
Something happened.
You're right. You're one of the first to say, you know, maybe they were, you know, looking into the future and they were able to do that. Maybe they were remote viewers. But my gut tells me they were making images of things that they saw.
Fine.
Right there.
Fine. You know. But the thing is that we are speculating. We don't really have them to say this is what it was.
No.
But we have people who have past life memories, cellular memory of various things. And I've taken an awful lot of people to Egypt who have past life memory, who will notice certain things, who will understand vibrational frequencies, harmonic resonance, how the water interacted and built a charge, and how the kind of power systems they have. And what's driven me since I'm 6 years old on this whole quest has been past life memories and cellular memory. So, you know, certain things come up, and when it's wrong, it turns my gut inside out. It's so hard on me. And so I don't know what I know or why I know it. But then over the years and over research and doing a lot of field work and basically being a slave to the story all my life, I go and I find things, and then I go, and it unravels it for me. But there's so much misinformation. It's enough to make you crazy. People have all these stories about what it could have been, and that's why I think it's important to situate this inside a larger sociocultural context, inside a larger, farther chronology, like a longer period of time, and to get out of our own way and stop looking at it through our own patriarchal lenses.
Well, that's a good point. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some newly revealed reptilian beings that Carmen will talk with us about. I mean, absolutely riveting. We'll get into levitation, try to get her reaction from what Edward Leed Scanlon might have been doing down at Coral Castle as well. Her website, pyramidcode.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. If you haven't seen the images she's been talking about, just go to coasttocoastam.com. You might have to hit your refresh button, but there they are. We'll be back. Carmen, let's spend some time talking about Dendera. Tell me about this era, the road to Dendera open again. It had been closed, you say, for 12 years. That's incredible all by itself. And then this newly revealed reptilian beings and star maps. Tell me about this. This is fascinating.
It totally is. Well, one of the things that I notice about the temples along the Nile is the distance that they are away from the river now. And so because we know that the Nile has migrated, it seems that the temples that are farthest away from the Nile would be the oldest. And so if you look at the Luxor Temple, it's right across the street from the river. Karnak is a couple of feet away. Komombo, you come right upon it on the cruise ships. Temple of Isis, you can't tell anymore because of the Aswan Dam having flooded it and put it on an island. But Abydos and Dendera are miles away from the Nile. Now, if you go up on the ceiling at Dendera on the roof, which you're not allowed to do anymore, but years ago I was able to go up there, you can see way, way off in the distance is the river. So the other thing about Dendera is that it's so old that there is also a temple underneath it. And so that's the other thing, is that we seem to have geological layers and temporal layers of time that make these temples older. So as I described in the last segment, that Abydos has a temple that's a full 30 feet underneath.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into one of the chambers in the Temple of Dendera, there's a hole just on the side, and what you can see if you look through is the tops of temple pillars. Well, that's the case at Giza, too. There's a Temple of Isis there that was cemented over now and paved over by our close personal friends in the Department of Antiquities. But it's like very few people understand how these layers really are indicating a completely different time frame and a different belief system and different stuff going on.
Fascinating.
Incredible. Not only that, in the crypts where there's no windows, there's no soot from, they had no light down there, so they must have had some kind of source of light. So, you know, that speaks to different power sources and all kinds of things. So, every temple in Egypt had Christian occupancy in the early parts of AD, so 200-300 AD. And for several hundred years, actually, the Christians made these mud brick encampments around the pyramid, around the temples, and massive. And so they had many, many people who would live there and would actually spend their time destroying the artifacts and the frescoes. And so you see these little chisel marks where they sharpen their chisels, and you wonder what the lumpy, bumpy parts are on the temple walls, and that would be their favorite part, and then they would just smash away for years. So in Dendera, part of the time they actually were inside the temple, mm-hmm. and they had fires in there. So the ceiling ended up full of soot, and it's very pronounced as well at Edfu, which is another temple that's farther away from the river. And between fungus over the years and soot, you ended up with a thick layer of black all over the entire temple, like the walls, the ceiling, everything. So in the past, when we would go in the police escort to go down the road was closed. There was once or twice a day, convoy would go.
They didn't want people down there, did they?
Well, that's another thing. Like, it was in response to the Luxor incident, which was a crisis, but it was an isolated incident that happened on the West Bank, which is a completely different region.
Right.
And in response to say, okay, we're going to keep you safe, kind of like, you know, the way the airlines think of things when there's mm-hmm. a terrorist incident, they look the other way and, you know, give us another level of control, and that's supposed to fix the problem that's over on the other side. And so they closed this road that's completely unrelated to the area where this happened. There was, you know, you'd go down the road, you knew there wasn't anything happening. But what it did was it restricted the access, and it took Dendera and Abydos off the beaten path of the major temples when people get a package tour to go to Egypt, a classic package tour from any old travel agent, right? So, anyway, they left the temple over these 12 years, basically not doing any work on it, and they could have been doing a lot. Like, they're making a lot of money. Like, Egypt's quite full, and they're, you know, charging a high price for people to get in, and there's thousands and thousands of people that go every day to the temples along the beaten path. And anyway, I was not in Egypt for 10 months, and I always go to Abydos and Dendera if we can. And all of a sudden, we walked into the first hypostyle hall, and divided right down the center, half was black and the other entire half was clean. The ceiling, the walls, the temple pillars, and I cannot tell. I mean, I hardly spent any time in the rest of the temple because I stood there with my jaw hanging open looking up.
How do you explain that?
Why they cleaned it. They're not allowed to add color, but they are allowed to take off fungus and soot.
Okay.
And it didn't take, I mean, eight, ten months. I mean, I don't know that they had even started.
Why only half?
Well, because they didn't get around to it.
Okay.
I mean, they could have done it 20 years ago. So I don't understand, you know, any of the political details of who decides what when. And it shows that it's possible because at Esna, it's taken them years to do, like, you know, half as many pillars and never mind the ceiling and the walls. Like, it's just painstaking. Anyway, I don't know if they used a chemical on it or what they did, but for sure it's against the rules of restoration to add color. So what they've done is they've taken something off and they've revealed the original color. So it's cobalt, turquoise, wine, burgundy, and gold, and then the white. And it is stunningly beautiful. The details are so incredible. And the Hathor pillars, like Hathor is the only being that has temple pillars dedicated to her. Everywhere else, you see lotus and papyrus capitals at the top of the pillar, but not a being. And it's unbelievably gorgeous because her hair is done, and there's these little lotus flowers that go up in the clips that are in her hair. And then there's winged discs on the wall. And then when you look up on the ceiling, there's it's so detailed. It's like an entire story. And I have it on HD video. The camera was very cooperative. They let me take pictures, like for all these years when I've been trying to get video and pictures. No, madame. You know,
and nobody knows anything about this car.
I know. And I saved it for you. I've done a lot of radio interviews since my last Coast show. I said, I'm not telling anybody about this unless I'm on Coast. So this is hot off the press. You're not going to find pictures on Flickr or anything. I mean, this, maybe if people know to go and look, they'll take them in the future. But I was dumbfounded to see it. There is a Hathor cow with wings and four ram heads. There are frog-headed beings with pharaonic bodies, all kinds of lizards and snakes and reptiles. And I just put one little section up there. But there's star maps and solar boats that William Henry will tell you are wormholes. And then there's the baboon that depicts time. And then there's stars above. And they're traveling through the zodiac. So you see all the zodiac images. And then you've got the body of Nui, who the milk of her breasts is the milk of the Milky Way. So her feet touch the ground and she arches over and her hands touch the other side. And the motion of the sun through a day, or the sun cycles that go through longer periods of time in the Egyptian cosmology, are all depicted. And it's this enormous story. And before, all we could see is that, yeah, that's the rough outline of a boat. Okay, and that may be a little star, but you couldn't see the whole thing. So I'm just starting to look at it and see the details on the hieroglyphic panels in between, and to see that the hieroglyphs, they're not an alphabet. There's 4,000 hieroglyphic symbols, and then there's extra symbols that we've never seen before, and this is what's showing up here and there.
What do you think they're trying to say with these bizarre creatures?
How about something like, beings came from the stars. They could travel between dimensions. They perhaps walked around here among us. I mean, Tom Kenyon talks about the Hathors.
It so far. Keep going.
A race of beings that were standing columnar waves. Why are the temples 40 feet high? Because maybe the beings are 30 feet high. There's all kinds of evidence of giants. Michael Cremo talks about them. I've seen huge sarcophagi that are buried at Saqqara. Like, I've spent a lot of years doing things that you can't do now and seeing things. And so very tall beings. Now, Graham Hancock's going to tell you therianthropes are half animal, half human. And when you get into altered states of consciousness, those are the beings that meet you. He talks about ayahuasca experiences, which is a medicinal plant that you take in the Amazon jungle. But trance dancing. There's all kinds of ways to access altered states. Now, for sure, the Egyptians were doing that, and there's much evidence about that. But so maybe these beings were going between back and forth between the other planets. X marks the spot. I mean, one of the things about the pyramids is you can see them from space in Google Earth. You can see them from 20 miles away, and they reflect light and the shapes of them, so you always know where you are. So, there's something very dramatic here. And you'll see reptilian-faced beings every once in a while in the temple walls in other places in Egypt. But this is like a storyboard, a massive storyboard of much more than that. And I can't tell you how surprised I was to see it because of the fact that it's Abydos. Or sorry, Dendera, but Abydos also has the ancient.
That's not remarkable. Does any of this echo the work of what Zechariah Sitchin did with the Sumerians?
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And if you go back far enough in terms of, you know, remote viewing and past, I don't know if remote viewing is accessing all of it, but certainly I know, and I know for myself, that there's a storyline in there that includes the reptilian beings.
Does any of it echo Genesis in the Bible?
Well, the biblical story is always up for interpretation.
Yes.
And so, yes, no. How about that for an answer?
Sounds like you're running for politics, Carmen. Yes. No.
Well, I don't want to make too many comments about the Bible.
I know you don't like to speculate without having some evidence or proof, but I've got to tell you, to be able to see these objects, these symbols, something happened during this era a long, long time ago, and these people depicted it. They drew it. It's truly remarkable.
Well, I don't think we can argue it now. Like, the ceiling is evidence. You know, like when I did my last interview with you, I didn't want to use, you know, the A word for alien or, you know, presuppose. But, you know, as time's going on and there's disclosure and so many people have stories and there's, you know, sooner or later, I think we have to explain this.
Well, and, you know what? That's the key phrase. Sooner or later, we do have to explain this. We can't just scarf it off as something, you know, that doesn't exist. It's real. It's there. It's been witnessed. You see it. And people have to start interpreting this and simply say, you know, it's the most common denominator is probably what it is. And if these people are doing crafts, flying craft and submarines and reptilian-looking humans, then that's probably what was roaming around this planet a long time ago.
Well, and where did they live? In the stars. You know, what do we see in Starry Night Crow, the traveling through the constellations? What does we talked about this last time. Walter Crittenden was talking about the sun being in a binary star system.
Right.
And when I plugged it into Starry Night, poof, here we go. It's all rotating around the extra galactic grid, has its center point as Sirius, and the rest of it rotates around it. I mean, this is very serious. Ha, ha, ha.
Very good.
But it fits. Now, there are certain, you know,
and don't forget, add in the, you know, the Dogon tribe, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
you
the,
bet.
You know,
and
that visitation.
They kept to themselves. They didn't mix with human culture. When Islam came into Egypt, they walked away. They walked all the way to Mali, and they started to, you know, repopulate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They only have a verbal language. They have written symbols. The Dogon priests can still utter some of the phrases of the hieroglyphic-looking text. Now, what we see everywhere in Egypt is dimensional doorways, doors within doors within doors. There's the Serapeum that they've got locked shut. Do you know what that is?
No, tell me.
Well, the Serapeum is at Saqqara, and the entrance is right beside the Department of Antiquities office there. And Saqqara is a place that's got some very, very interesting things, but they won't let you go anywhere. And, you know, since 1977, I've been, you know, going around by myself trying to find out what I can. And the rules have changed along the way. And there were times when we can go into the Serapeum. And what it is 22 huge sarcophagi that are 20 tons base and 5 tons. We're talking 10,000 pounds. Covers. No inscriptions. Granite. That go around in an oval in these enclaves. They tried to move one, and it got stuck in the hallway. They say that they were found full of ibis bulls, but a bull isn't that shape. It's just the way they say that they use bull sacrifice for the crystal bowls in Abu Ghraib. I mean, a bull doesn't fit in there either. I mean, they're just grasping at straws. And maybe at some point in the more recent times in the dynasties, somebody put something else in there. But there is absolutely no way that that's what it was at the beginning. And I've brought people down there who are incredibly sensitive. And on more than one occasion, see, I know what I think, but I've kept my cards pretty close here. I haven't been talking about this. Over all these years, I've just been waiting for a chance to explain it in a way that had a context to say it in. And it's been said that they were the teleportation chambers. That there was a liquid that would have been in something that looked like mercury. People have envisioned this silvery liquid substance, and there was a beam me up, Scotty, dematerialize, rematerialize. Now, last time I was on, we talked about the Siddhis, S-I-D-H-I-S, from the Vedic culture in India, which talked about the transmutation of the atom. We know that science fiction is more science than fiction, right? And that once the high-level initiates were able to transmute the atom, which means in terms of water, the hydrogen and the oxygen molecule would blow apart, and then the two elements would function in a different way. Well, we're 70% water, so we blow the molecule apart inside ourselves. Then telepathy, manifestation, levitation, which is anti-gravity, bilocation, teleportation, and alchemy were all possible because all of them have a similar function. That they're doing something different, but they all require the ability to transmute the atom.
Do you think there might be a portal there?
Absolutely, I do. I'm saying that a bit too quickly. And the portal was reversed. Like a lot of the, I'm saying way too much here. All of the energetic work, though, that we were doing, there came a point at Saqqara where it was so over-controlled by, I'm going to say, them, the reptilian beings, and their time is done. And that's part of the significance of 2012. Like the planet was taken over, and I think that Zachariah Sitchin's War of Gods and Men, and the planet was taken over for the period of time from 3113 BC to 2012. Their time is done. There was a transition period at the beginning, and there's a transition period now, and that portal's been reversed now.
Where did they go, Carmen?
Well, they're infiltrated. They're still here. They're still running. You know what they're running. I mean, they still have a lot of...
They've transformed, haven't they?
Well, they're walking among us. They're shapeshifters.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. The website, pyramidcode.com. Just fascinating discussion with Carmen Bolter. She's been to Egypt more than 20 times, and she's come back this time with an incredible story that we're sharing with you right now at Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, george@coast2coastam.com. More Coast to Coast continues in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Carmen, let's talk a little bit more about the teleportation devices there. That fascinates me. Then we'll get into some more of your travels. You said there was a liquid. So you think this liquid was used for whatever they were doing?
Well, now let's clarify, because at the break you said in the pyramid. No. Underground in a place called the Serapeum is where these huge black granite sarcophagi are. Sarcophagi, for lack of better words. But in the Great Pyramid, they thought that was a burial sarcophagus, but it's not.
Okay.
And so when they opened the Great Pyramid, they found it full of white powder. So they were doing all kinds of alchemical stuff. And science fiction, as we call it now, transmutation. Okay? So, yes, there was this silvery substance that reminds me of mercury, but it couldn't have been. And I think that they would get in and they would dematerialize their bodies and rematerialize on the home planet. Of course, everybody wasn't doing that. And that's the other thing that we need to understand in these sophisticated areas. And one of them is called the Band of Peace, where they had the energy from the pyramids. It's six different sites that expands about 15 miles. There was a high level of energy that was only for high-level initiates. The common populace was still in the fields doing the farming. And so there were special beings, I think, that were coming and going. I do. And if you even think about the Hathors and Hathor herself, she's got cow ears. Think of Avatar. They're humanoid, but they're not human. They are, but they're not. So shape-shifting and moving between dimensional spheres and using these solar boats that look like wormhole physics, I think they were moving between the dimensions.
What do you think they came here for, Carmen? Well, I mean, what was their interest? Sitchin says gold. They needed gold to spread into an atmosphere.
Well, I think that sounds like, okay, maybe. Maybe that's how it started. I think it would be more sophisticated than that. Think about the notion of starseed and other planets, perhaps
colonizing.
More developed. Yes, colonizing. It's, you know, it's not an idea that's too far from our mind now when we think about Mars missions and, you know, all of that. So the Dogon talk about their teachers coming. You know, there was wisdom and capabilities from other places. It's not that far-fetched. I mean, after all the hundreds of nights that you've been on the air for all these years, we've been listening to this sort of thing, but we haven't put it together, perhaps, as where they came in and out. And maybe there was more than one place on the planet, but it sure seems that Giza and the pyramid fields where Grand Central X marks the spot.
That's fascinating. It really is.
I wrote a screenplay called Out of the Blue years before I put the pyramid code together.
Where is it now?
It's between covers, sitting here, and it's telling the story from the perspective of back and forth between now and then and past life memories, and it puts it together in a more robust way that you don't have to believe it, sort of thing. So it's, but you know the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Oh yeah.
Fiction has to make sense. No, the other way around. Nonfiction
has to make
sense. The other way around. Fiction has to make sense. Nonfiction, reality, doesn't make sense anymore. We've been told so many lies that, you know, we expect politicians to lie. We expect school to be teaching us something that we, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't pertain to real reality. Like something far-fetched. You know, we're criticized for having thoughts that are far-fetched, but maybe they make more sense than the rest of it.
Maybe. Maybe. How did they build the pyramids? How did they levitate those blocks?
Well, I'm sure it's anti-gravity. I envision large lifters and small nudgers. I think it was fields within fields within fields. It had to do with humans being human divining rods that were connecting the cosmic energy to the earth, the telluric energy, and the telluric energy into the cosmos. So there was some kind of an energy charge building. But we're talking huge energy here. We're talking 22 pyramids that were emanating sound resonance frequencies. We're talking, as you'll see in the pyramid code, the schist disk that would spin and create a vibrational tone that mimicked the vibrational frequency of the planet. There were these reverberation shields. There was sound and light technology. And all of this built a charge that was then enough to create this anti-gravity. And there's absolutely no way, impossible, for the number of blocks there are in the Great Pyramid, that it could have been done manually. There aren't enough trees to roll things on logs. It doesn't make any sense at all. I have seen workers in Egypt repair a floor at the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut with little bricks that are maybe 8 inches across and, you know, 3 inches high, and stack them all, and 12 of them trying to pull this thing up the ramp with wheels, and they barely could do it. And so we've seen all kinds of things of them trying to build a capstone and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like even Stonehenge. They replicated it out of styrofoam, and they had trouble moving it. Well, styrofoam isn't as heavy as rock.
Do you think Edward Leete Scanlon, the guy who built Curl Castle down there by himself in Florida, he knew the secrets of the pyramids? He would tell people he did. Yeah.
Well, absolutely, and I think it's fascinating that he kept it secret. But I also understand that not only did he build it, he moved it.
He moved it. That's
true. To a different location after he built it.
Yes.
I mean, you're definitely proving that you know how to move these big stones. And so, I mean, I've been to Malta, and the quarries are at the top of the hills in Malta, and they've got a whole lot of rough round balls. And it makes sense that 10 or 12 people could start at the top of a hill and roll them down and put them up, because they're not tight fitting. So I'm not against the idea that, you know, primitive people would wrap rope around something and pull it along and roll it along. Fine. If it's plausible, I'll go with that. And I think that Malta, that's part of how they did it. But I don't think that's the case with the Egyptian pyramids at all.
When Leete Scanlon moved from one spot to the other, he had a guy with a flatbed truck after they put the blocks on the truck. Now, the guy didn't see him do it, but he somehow moved these blocks onto the truck, and he moved it. The guy drove them over to a homestead, and Leete Scanlon apparently told him, leave, and I'll take care of this. And he kept wondering, how in the heck is this 120-pound guy going to do any of this? How did he even get these things on my flatbed truck? And he said, you know, as soon as he went and came back, Leete Scanlon was finished.
Yep.
He had moved everything.
Well, and we have anti-gravity devices now, but we also have to understand that the technology that has led itself to many different discoveries has been squashed down by the powers that be that want us paying for utilities, that have kept us controlled. They're getting all our money.
Bingo.
So
bingo.
Anybody who wanted to develop these things, I mean, it should be, instead of the kinds of things, that activities that go on in schools, that people should be excited about exploration and these sorts of things, because it's possible. And now we have internet, and we can look on YouTube and see things floating around, and it's anti-gravity. So if you can do it on a small scale, I mean, they're pretty comfortable moving little things around. Of course it can be done on a big scale.
Now, I suspect, Carmen, they already have this. They're using it in a big way, and they're just not telling us about it.
Well, you know, disclosure would be good on many levels.
Yep. Yes, it would. Okay, let's move on throughout Egypt here. Some of the other things that you came across that just continue to add to this puzzle that we're looking at here. What about ancient artifacts? Did you stumble across anything there?
When you say that, what comes to mind is what's happening in the museum. Like, I've spent a lot of time in the museum, a lot of time over the last years. I lived in Egypt for periods of time, and I did a lot of research there. I'd go in there for 2 hours at a time because you get saturated. In the olden days, we were able to take pictures. And I am telling you, the museum, it used to be that if you spent 1 minute at each exhibit, you'd be in there 9 months.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff. It's like a warehouse.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that museums are supposed to have a location for an item, and if the item's moved, taken for restoration, taken to a special exhibit in another country, there's a sign that says, this is the item, this is where it is, and this is when it's coming back.
Exactly.
You don't do that in the Cairo Museum.
Why?
They have moved the schist disc 4 times. There's a head of King Tut with a distended skull growing out of a lotus. They've moved that 4 times. When I was doing the photo shoot for the pyramid code, they had people in there with ledgers, and they're supposedly recording where everything is. And I'm telling you, the museum is emptying out. There was a news story in the local paper in Arabic that my guide described to me while I was there, mid-February till March, where 100 artifacts disappeared out of the National Museum, and they found a quote-unquote, a few in the garden. A couple of years ago, there was a story about a container that's huge, like a train container, full of artifacts, they said, were from Khalil Khalili Market. which is the largest and oldest bazaar on the African continent. And they were not fake. They were real. And there are stories of the something going on at the Sphinx where high-level officials and politicians are there, and there's artifacts. And from one frame to the next, the artifact's gone. It shows up on internet in Japan.
Amazing.
And a lot of these artifacts were coming out of the Valley of the Kings. But the things disappearing out of the museum are a much bigger concern. And I keep track of this stuff.
How are they getting out of there? It's got to be organized.
Exactly. Now, I used to be able to take pictures in there, and I've walked around, and I know where things used to be, and I look for certain items, and they're not there anymore.
Yeah, they're gone.
So the last time I was there, there's one of the King Tut jewelry rooms was half closed off with a big table with one of these big ledger books, and all the stuff was out of there. Now, they're using the reason that they're building a new museum. You saw a big news story maybe two years ago, where they moved the statues of Ramses from Ramses Square, and they put a statue of the president up there instead. Well, his statue was still standing, the Ramses statue, along Alexandria Road in crates. It's just a shame.
It was a $2 million move, wasn't it?
It was a $2 million move. They never dug the foundation for this museum. They're using the excuse that they're moving the stuff, and they're gonna have nicer lighting in the new museum, so they're not gonna have as many artifacts. So people aren't supposed to notice that this stuff is disappearing. But there's this gold crown that has like a snake-like pattern going across the Corpus Colossum, and I look for that all the time. There's lots of beautiful things, and it's missing. They're missing. And there's stories saying that they're gone, and they're going, oh, well, and then they're taking these ledgers to say what's there. How about this? Last March, there was an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum in New York of Hatshepsut statues. And there were 30 statues that were broken all at the same time, 20 years after her death. We don't know why somebody got upset about her, but they apparently did. But what they did is they broke them, and they put them all into a pit at Deir el-Bari near the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut. And when they pulled them out, it was an American team, and they started putting them back together. And then some of them went here, and some of them went there, and some of them ended up in New York because they were given as a gift, and they got distributed. And so last March at the Met, they brought them all together. They opened a special exhibit room, and I stood there in awe with all these statues together because she was so beautiful. And then they have the nerve to say she was obese and ugly. Thanks a lot. You know. Anyway, so fine. And I got to be alone in the room, the guards just on the outside. And it just felt so special, and I thought, well, that one's from here, and that one's from there. And then I went back to the Cairo Museum a year later, and they didn't put the statues back.
Jeez.
So all along the top edge of the New Kingdom, 18th Dynasty, Hatshepsut Room, there's like 8 statues that aren't there.
Is it Prophet or something else?
Well, what else could it be?
Well, they could be hiding them for fear of some tragedy.
Oh, well, fine. Well, then, well, I never thought of that. But what my guide was explaining to me is that, you know, they say, well, they're in New York. Oh, well, then they went on to somewhere else, and they went on to somewhere else. They'll be back, and then people forget what's where. But I don't forget that stuff. Like, to me, it's really important. And then there's other things to protect. I mean, the King Tut stuff is probably more valuable than anything else because most of it's gold. But it's more familiar to people. And that's why I think I'm told, they don't want people with their cell phones or with their cameras inside the museum because they're date and time stamped.
Exactly.
So if something's missing, they'll see it. So I'm not going to claim that I know what's going on, but I am watching these news stories, and I can tell you the items that I'm looking for that aren't there. So I've been over there 24 times now, and one time I went 4 times in a year, and every single time I go to the museum, and often more than once. So it's pretty familiar to me.
Is there a concern by the Egyptian government?
Well, I'm guessing maybe they have something. Well, I shouldn't say that, but No, they're not expressing. It. They're not expressing a concern. And the newspaper articles are coming out. There's no way I'm going to guess what's going on. All I know is that there are articles about this. It's been going on for years. I mean, at the beginning of Egypt, there was so much stuff in the 1900s. There were 130 seated Sekhmet statues that were made by Amenhotep III, who's Akhenaten's father. And there's only four in the National Museum in Egypt. There are six in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. So from people doing excavations, and most the countries that were helping with excavations were gifted by the Egyptian government with very lofty and lovely materials. So the obelisk that's in Washington, the other one at the Louvre, they were given. There's a record of that. Even the bust of Nefertiti. It was a deal. They found all this stuff at Amarna. Some of the stuff stayed in Egypt and some of the stuff went other places. Now, there was something a little shady about how they got it. But they paid for it, and now Zahi wants the bust of Nefertiti to go back. He wants the original Rosetta Stone to go back because there's a replica in the National Museum. Well, these items and the story of those items are traceable, and all I'm saying is that it's quite disturbing because there's so much missing.
Over the years, as you've gone into the museum, have you seen anything that would depict extraterrestrial races or anything like that? In the museums?
That's a really good question. And you know what? Anything, no, they take it out. But, yes, there are sarcophagi in there. They have sarcophagi. If you go through the wing on the second floor, you'll see a transition between the golden-faced mummies from a later period and then, you know, the way they were built before and before and before. And then you'll see smaller shaped ones that may have been for children, and then other shaped ones you're finding the mummies. If you go in the mummy room, you can see that the mummies are smaller, like their skeletons are smaller than we are. Whoop, got music there?
It's time for a break. We'll be back for more. Carmen, you were talking about these small mummies that you would see these sarcophagi for.
Yes, thanks. So as you move into the other room, then there are boxes, sarcophagi, for 12 or 14-foot beings. And, you know, somebody even mentioned recently, well, how do you know it's not a box within a box within a box? Well, that wasn't their style. They put, like in King Tut's, they put a shrine within a shrine within a shrine. And so I think they're expecting us not to notice the difference in the size. I was just saying, when you go into the mummy room, you can see that the skeletons and the mummies themselves are smaller than we are, generally speaking. And so that doesn't make sense. And then there's another place I was thinking at the break. On the outside of King Tut's gold shrine, there's many of them that fit inside each other. There is a sequence where there's a human that's got their legs kind of closed together like Osiris would, which indicates that they're dead. And their head is lifting off, and there's these lines that go between, and then there's these snake images and cat images, and then they're leaning back. I mean, you'd have to see the photograph to know what I mean here, but I am telling you, it is strange. It looks like moving between the dimensional spheres, and there's something odd about it. There's no question. But you're right. Most of everything else that's in there are human-faced, equiline, beautiful human-looking beings, and dishes and things they would have used. Go ahead.
Right. You said something at the outset, which I think is very important. Why isn't anyone investigating these possibilities, these incredible possibilities that this planet had been visited before, and there it is, whether they go to Abydos or Dendera or any place else? Why don't they do this?
Because it's unpopular, because it's against what you're supposed to study in school. I was going to do my PhD in archaeology, and I ended up doing it in linguistics because I realized that you can't come out with anything. You can do hardcore research, and you're not. There's no platform to speak on. And so I think that the patriarchy's agenda was to erase evidence of everything other than itself, during the witch trials. They traumatized people through torture and burning at the stake and all of that, so that all of the magic and the magic was sent into tarot, numerology, astrology, because it became really unpopular to understand that we could be self-empowered. We could have high levels of consciousness. God's within us, not outside of us. And the whole system that has, you know, religious, political, control system fits together. And we're not supposed to understand this. And it's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah. It really is.
It really is. And so they've got to unplug us in different ways. And, you know, I've got to say that going in the temples in this last trip, I was absolutely astounded at how irreverent people were. They're shouting and shoving in the temples. And this is a holy place. Like, what are you doing? And people have no sense of honoring. And so a lot of years, like after the Luxor incident, the temples were quite empty, and I'd take my groups and we could do meditations and light candles in the Holy of Holies and, you know, tone and do something vibrationally, acoustically tuned and spiritual. And, you know, now we have to strategize to go into the temples when they're not open. And on my groups, we have went into the Great Pyramid by ourselves. We had sunrise between the paws of the Sphinx alone. And that's, you know, not that easy to do, and it's expensive, but it's possible, and then you can really feel the energy. But people have been dumbed down to the point where they have no sense that they're standing in a sacred place. And that the cavities, sorry?
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say the cavities of the human body are geometrically, sacred geometry, represented in the temples. And so just standing in an Egyptian temple, if you're quiet and you feel, can actually give you some kind of an experience, a spiritual experience. Like, none of this happens by accident.
What are your thoughts on the Sphinx and Edgar Cayce's predictions, basically, prophecy, that there's something at the base of the Sphinx, the Hall of Records?
Well, he, under the Sphinx, I think, is a misnomer. I think that there's a lot of secrets beneath and in front of the left paw, which is the Sphinx temple. And beside the left paw is the area where it would have been the temple of Isis. And the initiates did some interesting activities connected to their training that had their base in those two places. And so I think the secrets and what actually happened there has been locked shut and buried and cemented over, and the passageways that are down there are closed. And so I think that there were a lot of access points and consciousness-raising activities in a very sophisticated way, where there was cross-dimensional interaction, and it all happened right there. Now, I don't expect an English book to be found, and I think that we end up having narrow ways of understanding what the Hall of Records is. The Halls of Amenti, what does that mean? In the Emerald Tablets, they talk about it. And so we do have, you know, documents that speak in myth and in metaphor that are actually accessing these sorts of things, but we aren't in the headspace to comprehend it. And yes, I think that beneath and beyond the left paw of the Sphinx and down, there's something, but not what you would expect, because we make up what we would expect because we're looking through our own cultural lenses, right?
See, I thought maybe we'd find flying machines down there, plans for the pyramids, just about everything.
Well, there's no plans for the pyramids, and that is an obvious oversight. We don't see that anywhere. It's a curiosity. The things that look like the passageways inside the pyramids are actually on the tomb walls in the Valley of the Kings, talking about the bardos and how you navigate between this incarnation and the next. The Egyptians were sure they had no word for death, and they were sure that they would become something else, and that their soul would live on. They called it the Ba. So the Ka is the body double. So if you were to bilocate, your Ka is the one in the other place, and your body is still where you started. Your ba is your soul. So when you leave your body in a time of death or in an out-of-body experience, it's your ba that is that lives on. And so, you don't see, there are no plans for the, you're not going to find plans for the pyramids anywhere, and I'm not expecting that we are. The other thing you don't find is when you see the crowns, the white crown and the red crown that they keep insisting are the crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt. No burial has ever found a crown. Those are largely symbolic. And Hakim said that they were the thymus and the womb, and that they were a representation of the sacredness of procreation. And so there are things that you look at in Egypt that are symbolic. There are things that are interdimensional and multidimensional. And then there are concrete things like plates and combs and wigs and things. So it's a curiosity how it all fits together. I really don't think that there are flying machines down there. But when you think about something being buried, the boats were buried, the solar boats. And they said they were the boats for the pharaoh to go to his home on the other side. But the boats were watermarked. And the river moved. The river migrated. And so they buried. There's quite a few places. If you stand at the top of the pyramid, I've climbed it a few times, and you can look down and you can see the places where there would have been a solar boat. And so at Abu Roush, there's more up there. Now, where the boats ended up now, there's one that they built a structure around it so you can go in and look at it. And so, yes, they buried vessels, and there is a network, a huge, enormous network underneath all the pyramids from one end to the other of the pyramid fields that expand for 15 miles. And part of it's a limestone aquifer, and part of it is man-made honeycomb zigzag-shaped passageways. I spent 5 years absolutely riveted to find out as much as I could about those underground passageways. And they are numerous, and they are blocked. And they used to have openings that came up onto the plateau in shafts where the sunlight would shine in, the water would flood when the Nile was in its place, the water would get energized from the beam of the sun, but also the stars would shine in. And when the water receded, there were exercises that the high-level initiates would do where they would go and do star. They would leave their bodies and they would go out and connect with a star. And the trick was to return and to be able to bring the knowledge back. So their bodies would be taken care of by attendants who were also high-level initiates, four, and one person would go. And this comes from past life memories verified by other psychics that have followed my work, but this is my understanding of how it worked. And then all cultures have these places where there would be 72 hours of integration or some kind of a test, where in Tibet they would bury the monks and they in a coffin or something, and they would have to maintain their cool and their breathing so that they could do the test. And you find on Easter Island there are these little alcoves. And so there's many initiation ceremonies that were done. And these were done down in those halls. And it's profound because you would notice the rotation of the earth, and when the star would be above the shaft and the chamber is below, it's almost like the initiate could leave out their crown chakra and connect with that star. And then their bodies would collapse because the ka had left. I made a mistake a minute ago. The ba is what carries on with you when you're dead, but the ka is what travels in and out or bilocates.
Of all your travels over the years, more than 20 years, was there one fascinating aspect of Egypt that still puzzles you, Carmen, that still perplexes you?
Well, the way this psychic archaeology works, because I had visions. I started out as a young child with visions, but then the visions became very specific about a place. And there was more than one place. But at first, I just kept seeing, this pool of water. And then there was another place where I would see this little door. And I searched and searched and searched and couldn't find it and came back and had the vision again. And I went, because there's something about being in the physical reality of Egypt that makes you, everybody's saying, well, this is, just this or just that. And it kind of strips you away from the magical aspects. And it's interesting that sometimes you can feel the magical energy there, but sometimes it's just bones and stones and sand. And anyway, so after 10 years of looking for this one place, I found it. And because there had been so much, no, this isn't it, this isn't it, no. And then when I found it, it's like the whole thing started running like a movie. I'm perplexed with how that could be so real. And it's happened to me in other places, in other sacred sites like on Crete at Knossos. And this is very real. Like I knew around the corner is this and up over there. And the whole thing was filled in as though it was happening. Now, that happened to me at Machu Picchu on one side of the site where I actually spent the night on the site. And I was able to, okay, they did weaving here and they did pottery there. And I was walking around. And I had a real sense of what the actual locations were for. Now, that's disconcerting. That's perplexing. That's difficult to handle. That's like manifesting something out of nothing and going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Your brain, my brain, did not want to understand that. It didn't know how to. And so I've had to deal with some pretty interesting experiences with this. And it's real. And I've had some help with it, and, you know, I've come to understand it, but it's perplexing for sure. Now, Amarna is a place where Nefertiti and Akhenaten built a new city because there was so much corruption within the Amun priesthood that they decided they were going to start over and move
what,
back.
In what period would we be
That was
about
the 18th dynasty after Hatshepsut, so 1350 B.C., somewhere in there.
Okay.
And there was big, big problems, and the Amun priesthood was filled with power, and they remind me of the Catholic Church, how they would make people pay for their salvation, and it was religious instead of spiritual. And so when I went there, came around the corner, and I saw the light shining off the side of the mountain, and I just absolutely fell apart right there. I just started sobbing, and I was like, what's going on here? Well, it was there. I lived there. And I saw the sun shining off that very same mountain from another incarnation, and my whole being just totally was grabbed by it. And when my foot touched the actual soil of the place, I mean, I felt myself morphing into the other body. And then I walked around, and I just had feelings, I mean, everything about what happened where, and, you know, that it was running like a movie. But I also happened to have brought some people there that also were clairvoyant and clairsentient and had lived there as well. And we knew this. We went there together on purpose because we had developed a long conversation about our past life memories there. And they had each identified who they had been.
Would you go back there again?
I'm going back there in October. I'm taking a group there. 10-10-10 will be in the Great Pyramid by ourselves.
How does all this, Carmen, tie into 2012?
Aha. Well, it's curious that the first dynasty started in 3113 BC, isn't it?
Yes.
That to me, that's the start of the patriarchal ways of being and thinking. And 2012 is the end. So it's the end of the cycle of bloodbath, darkness, blood from death instead of blood from life. So it's my conviction that everything before it was matriarchal and balanced. And so 2012, it's not the end of the world. I think it's the beginning of a return to where we were, where we had some sense of sanity and goodness and connection and love. I mean, people all around the world are good. And so it ties into 2012 because we're hitting the absolute center point at December 21st, sunset Giza. Like, I've looked at this. I've looked at 11-11 in the morning. I've looked at 2011, October 28th, when Joseph Kellerman and those said, but it's the last step of before the last rung of the Mayan calendar. And all of these dates, they don't line up. They don't. And so 2008, it was on the edge. Like, if you were to hold a knife against a glass of water, it's on the edge. And then across, and then straight center, 2012. So at each year, we've been dipping into the energetic field coming into the exact conjunction of it. But you know, in astrology, if something is conjunct by 6 degrees, it's considered conjunct. If it's 7, it's out. If it's on, it's closer. But still, a conjunct is within a range. And so what's actually been happening is we've been passing through this energy for the last couple of years. And we're halfway through where it's touching this way. And so it ties in, because I believe, this is what I've come to see with the whole picture being told, and this is the what's in Out of the Blue in the screenplay, is that whoever they are, the reptilians, whatever, war gods and men, if you want to go to Sitchin, they won something and they wanted to control the Earth. And the Galactic Federation of Planets came in and said, you can't do that. It's a free will zone. You can't. They said, we want the Earth. You don't give it to us, we'll blow it up. So the decision was made that they could have it for one cycle. Not the cycle of the precession of equinoxes, but one Mayan cycle. And it's over. They're done. And so what we really can expect is a resurgence of sanity. That's what I'm putting my bid on.
Fascinating.
And that's how it ties in, because the Egyptians had it together. They were peaceful. They were intelligent. They were creative. They were connected to nature. They were healthy. They had 360 senses, not 5. You know, we've lost a lot. A lot. And we've been told that being a multidimensional being is not possible. It is. We're psychic. We're connected.
Let's take some phone calls with you, Carmen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, Carmen Bolter, and your phone calls as well. What's the fascination for you, Carmen, with Egypt? How did it all start for you?
I started having past life memories when I was a little girl, and it's the ancient sites that speak to me and recreating a picture of who the ancients would have been, because I'm disappointed with how we've turned out in our culture. I think there's a lot more to us and a lot more abilities that we could have to really connect with a true spirituality and a higher level of intelligence.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll start by going to San Diego. Madeline, west of the Rockies. Hi, Madeline.
Oh, hi. And Carmen, just quickly, I went to the Peabody Museum at Yale University when mm-hmm. I was fourth grade, and they had a dinosaur. I got the bug, and my Aunt Eleanor sent me a beautiful book called The Wonderful World of Archaeology, and it changed my life. That was it. I'm going to make a small joke. When my mother wanted to have that mother-daughter talk, I said, Mom, I'm going to Egypt. Don't worry. Don't worry about anything. Nobody's going to stop me. And I've been there twice, and there's home. Every time you go back, it's something new. But anyway, I don't really understand what ley lines are. And I've seen a program somewhere where they can cross. And I wondered if where the ley lines cross, is that a place of anti-gravity? And then I have another small question.
Thanks, Madeline. That's a really, really good question. Oh, I'm getting some feedback here.
No, that's okay.
Oh, no.
Go ahead.
Okay. Ley lines are telluric currents. They are energy lines that run inside the Earth. And now they're actually coming up about 2 or 3 feet. And so areas, like John Burke actually talked about this, and he's passed in the last little while, areas of discontinuity meets an area of continuity, which means that there's a conduction of energy, and where the lines cross is where a sacred site will be. And the biggest vector there is the Great Pyramid, and it's right on the center between two ley lines. But there's Michael lines that cross the British Isles and England. There's dragon lines that go across China. And they're all depicting the same thing. And so it's the natural energy current. Just the way birds have instincts to fly along rivers. It's almost like the instinctual patterns that the earth will, like the pulse, like the veins of the earth, if you will.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Tom in Tallahassee, Florida, first-time caller. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Carmen. Everything you're saying is resonating with me quite a bit philosophically. I got a theory that we're all part of an original creation story, but we don't know how or when it began. But there were two phases, I'm thinking, and the first phase would be the feminine, and whatever happened then, we had a lot of power, a lot of free will, and we did a lot of advanced things, but then we misused our power like we do now, and we came to a climax, and then now we're in the second phase of the story. I believe we're actually reliving the first story with the Jesus factor, though, in it, and we'll always have a little door open for us to be successful now, and I agree with you, you know, that we're getting close to, I call it cornering the virus, the spiritual virus that is the mindset that's keeping us in a cycle of pain, suffering, and death. And it has more to do with the masculine. And I like all the things you're saying. And I believe we're getting close to a big breakthrough on the positive end.
Well, thank you, Tom. Actually, the balance between the masculine and the feminine was essential to ancient Egyptians. And you see the symbolism all the way through it. And that's a real focus in the Pyramid Code. And it's also a focus in my book, Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. And the idea is, in the patriarchal times, which is 3114 BC till now, there has been a denigration of the feminine, and we're so out of balance, that's why we're hurting the planet. And so I'm glad that this is resonating with you. At the break, I was wondering if I'd said too many weird things, but I think we're here, and weird isn't weird anymore. I mean, I think it's time for these things to come out. And some kind of a story being told about what could have happened appeases our curiosity. And whether I'm right or not about the exact details of how it happened, it's true that we're out of balance and it's time for us to come back in. So thanks, Tom.
Now, you say that they still could be here among us. Explain that, Carmen.
Well, for sure, the secret government and people who are running the puppeteers that are the politicians are probably connected to this force.
Offspring or them?
Them. I don't know. Like, we'll never know for sure, but, I mean, certainly with all the coast shows you've done, you know that they're, yeah, I think that they're walking amongst us.
There are some families.
And they're running Big Pharma and the governments and the banks and all of that. And it's time for them to lose their grip.
That's an interesting take. Let's go to Larry in Carlisle, Arkansas, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Larry.
Good morning. Good morning. I was just wondering if I could ask Carmen to go ahead and tell me a little more about the evidence that she has about giants. Around the world, I guess.
Well, thank you. There was a piece that I left out of that story at Saqqara. When you face the entrance and go through the first hypostyle hall, first chambers on the very far left, all the way over on the other side where they don't let you walk anymore. One time I was there by myself, and one of the watchmen came and dangled some keys. And I nodded, and he went over and he opened this trap door, and there was this rickety ladder, and I went down, and I'd been in and out of so many holes by that point and entrances to passageways that I was quite comfortable with it. And down inside this hole was a stone sarcophagus for a 20-foot being. In the museum, they're like 12 to 14 feet high. And so I was astounded. I couldn't shake the thought of it for a long, long time. And then I realized that when they found it, they couldn't possibly bring it to the surface and put it out because it doesn't fit with anything else. And so they put it in the ground. And I'm sure this watchman, knowing that it's there, really wanted to show somebody. And after that, I saw the trap door again with the lock on it, but there's absolutely no way that I ever saw anybody go down there or anybody would acknowledge what's in there. So that's one big example. But even the fact that the temples are so tall, I mean, there has to be a reason why. I mean, there's resonance chambers and that sort of thing, but I think there was a different race of beings that were quite a bit taller that walked around then in Egypt.
Well, you know what? That's interesting you say that, Carmen, because there was a house I had where I had to do a lot of remodeling because the people who lived there must have been little because everything was low. Everything. If you sat at they had like a woman's makeup area. If you sat down at that table, your knees would barely be able to fit underneath it. Everything was low. The sinks were low. You almost had a sore back bending over. So I guess let's reverse that for a moment. Let's assume that there were giants during this era and they came from above. I guess they would make things big for them.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
It does. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Brian, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Brian.
How you doing? Real nice to be with you guys. Real quick questions. I
sure.
Highly appreciate answered. One, how would you know if you're like in the presence of what we'd call a shapeshifter, maybe hybrid? And the other question would be if you heard of the crystal skull theory and the hollow earth theory, how that interties with pretty much what you're talking about in 2012. And, you know, like I come to realize they say like on the Chinese constellation, every 12 years is the dragon Draco constellation. Ironically, 2012 would be the 12th year again. So, and, you know, like you said, it's maybe our time where we get back grip. Obviously, there's going to be a big fight for that. I don't see any reason why they'd want to just let that up so easy.
All right. Well, let's take them one at a time here. First of all, the hollow earth theory. Many people believe that there's something going on within this planet and that maybe extraterrestrials are there. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, somebody said to me once, if beings were living inside the Earth and it's dark down there, it would make sense that their eyes would get bigger.
Yes.
And if they're inside closed quarters and they don't have a lot of weight to have exercise, that their muscles would atrophy. And if they don't have exposure to sunlight, then their skin may go gray. That kind of made sense to me, that maybe they are living down there, and generation after generation, they're changing their appearance. There's lots of stories about places like Sedona and places where there's Mount Shasta, where people uh-huh. go in and out, and people are seeing beings, and there's stories of fairies and leprechauns and all kinds of beings that could be popping in and out of dimensions and out of the inside of the earth. I don't have a problem with that at all. And crystal skulls, they make sense too. We use crystals for everything. Crystals are crystal oscillators make everything work. They make Ethernet work. They make CDs work. They make watches work. And it goes on and on and on. There's almost nothing that's technological that isn't run by crystals. So a brain, a crystal skull, as a receiver of information, that makes perfect sense.
Okay, and as he talked about shapeshifters, how do you know? How do you know?
Well, you know what I think about? I'm thinking about the name of the movie, The Fifth Element, where the guy goes to get a plane ticket and he's standing at the counter and the lady says, I'm sorry, sir, there's no room on the flight. And he, the reptilian face comes through,
yes,
and then he gets it together and takes a breath, and he looks normal again, and then it happens a second time when he's frustrated. I thought, you know what? That's how it goes. That's what happens. There's this little sense of a snarl or even a sense of a tail, you know, and I've had that creepy feeling a couple of times, but I remember it because I just get the sense that they're bleeding through somehow and that they wear their human suit like we wear clothes.
Good point. Next up, we go to Cleveland, Ohio. Devin, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, good morning, Devin.
Oh, hey, thank you.
I was wondering
about the Bimini crystal found in the underwater pyramid by Dr. Ray Brown.
I was thinking that the addition of this crystal to the pyramid, that it could actually act as a large capacitor used to create a more harmonic crystal structure and help irrigate crops and charge the drinker's body with water. This crystal could also be what was also spoken of, the Ark of the Covenant.
I think the Ark of the Covenant is another story, but capacitor is a word that would fit with it as well. Yes, I agree with what you've just said. The harmonics, the positioning, top of a pyramid, carrying a resonance field, all of this is the language of the same thing that we're talking about. Now, the Ark of the Covenant, it strikes me that in the Queen's Chamber, in the corbelled little niche, that it could have slid right in there and charged up. And it always struck me when I heard Bible stories in catechism, and they left with the Ark of the Covenant, that it probably worked when they left with it. But as the farther away they got, it's like the batteries ran out, and it didn't work anymore because they had left the place where it recharged. And so it makes sense to me, being inside the Great Pyramid, that it could have charged. And perhaps there's other ways that the energy within it could have regenerated itself. But a little story is, in the days of Walkmans, batteries used to last me 12 hours when I went to Egypt, and I'd always take the dead batteries and put them in the pocket of my coat because I knew I'd wear my coat into the Great Pyramid. When I'd come out, the batteries would last for 6 hours. So a totally dead battery would get half a charge in this day and age when the pyramid's not working at full capacity. So the idea of crystals, charge, capacitors, and energy generation makes a lot of sense to me.
It's Greenville, South Carolina now. It's Evan's turn. Hi, Evan. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've got a theory that I'd like to mention and get your thoughts on, and
okay.
Also a question. My theory is that ancient Egyptians, extraterrestrials, and the, you know, beings that have been discussed on tonight's program were all much more deeply in tune with you know, the higher consciousness out there in the cosmos, that, you know, and I believe that we as a humanity are meant to be as in tune with that as they were. And I think that's, you know, something that 2012 has a lot to do with, that when that time comes, that we have to, you know, open up to that. And my other question is the stone tablet against the chest of the Sphinx and that altar. I'm very curious about that, and I'd like to know if there's if you know any information about that.
Okay, thanks, Evan. Those are two good questions. And I forgot the first one. I wrote it down here. A higher level of consciousness. Okay. If we are in this binary star system and we're talking about a 26,000-year precession of the equinoxes cycle, when we're close to our companion star, there's higher states of consciousness, and it takes 13,000 years roughly to get there. And then when we're outside, we have lower states of consciousness. The point of 2012 is the point of return from that farthest point. So while there's going to be a resurgence of high-level energy, we're creeping our way toward the golden age. Yes, the ancients that lived in Egypt that were exemplifying multidimensionality, dimensional shifts, all that sort of thing, were beings of high, high levels of consciousness. We are at the point, the lowest point. And some people, I think, who have the cellular memory of being high-level initiates carry the seeds of that, if you will. But everything in our society now is trying to distract us from that. And the fact that we can even have this conversation and that people are interested in this sort of thing, I think, is about our DNA holding the memory. So, and then the other question was, I wrote it down. I can't even read my own writing. I'm sitting by candlelight.
Well, let's go back to him for a quick one. Evan, go ahead.
Okay, it was the stone tablet in front of the sink.
Oh, the stone tablet in front of the sink, sorry. My glasses on. I'm sitting by candlelight. The stone tablet in front of the Sphinx, if you look at it, I've got very detailed pictures of it. There's a Sphinx facing one way and another Sphinx facing toward it. And the story is that Thutmose III went there, and the Sphinx was covered by up to sand up to the neck. And he heard a voice that said, if you uncover me, unbury me, I'll make you pharaoh. But who was Thutmose III? Thutmose I was in the 18th dynasty, was Hatshepsut's father. The second was her husband, and the third was her brother. And so the idea of the mirror image you'll see over and over again, where hieroglyphic will face the direction you're supposed to read it in. So it's not like Arabic that you just start from right to left, or English where you just start from left to right.
All right, we'll be back from left to right with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. I've got to ask you about your work, Angels and Archetypes. What got you into that area?
I was looking, okay, it all started when I was the director of the Women's Therapy and Research Center, and I was offered two full-time research assistants from the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, and they said, pick a research question. You can pick it as you like. So I asked, what happened in the switchover between matriarchy and patriarchy? And that led to 21 pages of bibliography in teeny tiny print and looking for little fragments of what was left over from matriarchal times and piecing back together the story. And so it's set up as 22 goddesses, and their higher selves are angels, and it follows along with tarot, numerology, and astrology. And what it is the lost knowledge. And men can balance their feminine consciousness, women can balance their masculine consciousness, and the whole thing adds up. So it's very much what the ancient Egyptians were about.
Were you happy with it, with the work?
Was I happy with it? Oh, well, they couldn't go very far because they couldn't find the journals, the feminist journals that the information was in. So I ended up taking a leave and going to Montreal to the Simone de Beauvoir Institute Library and finding the rest of it myself. So I'm not sure how much the research assistants actually contributed, but they certainly got me going on the quest.
And you're still teaching at the University of Calgary?
Yeah, I teach exclusively online, and okay. My students are all over the world. And, yep, I'm still teaching there.
You like that?
I do. I mean, I like the flexibility of teaching online, and I just spoke at a conference in Vancouver last weekend, but I realize that so much more of my day and my brain is filled with this stuff about Egypt than it is about what I'm doing at the university.
All right, let's go to Jim at Potosi, Missouri, on the wild card line. Jim, you're up with us. Hi.
Hi, George. Thanks for a wonderful show, and Carmen,
sure.
Appreciate the subject. It's a great presentation. I was wondering, do you find resistance? I mean, obviously, you have been finding resistance of the spread of obtaining more knowledge. Has the group, the Rosicrucians, been directly or indirectly, have you heard from them, giving you a fit, collecting information?
Actually, I don't know anybody personally involved in the Rosicrucians. The Rosy Cross is something that I've looked at, and I know that they've examined Egypt, but I don't have a direct connection with them.
Okay. And the word pyramid, do you understand why it says light from the middle? Has anybody ever explained that to you?
Well, the thing about the word pyramid is it's actually a Greek rendition of the word. In the ancient Suf language, which was the language of the people of Kempt, which is before Herodotus came to Egypt, it was called Per-Neter, which means house of nature. And that's indicating that it was a measurement, all the sacred geometry of what goes, Fibonacci sequence of what goes into nature. So whatever the word pyramid is going to describe, that's going to be, again, a later version of it.
Well, I was just wanting to let you know that I had an experience with a pyramid, and the light actually penetrated from the center of this thing.
And well, that's entirely possible.
And it was a solid object, and it could levitate. And when I started asking questions, everybody disbanded. You know, it was a Rosicrucian event, but it was very interesting. I mean, it was realistic. When the light appeared at the top, a low harmonic pulse would also sound. So.
Yes, so sound and light technology was what the ancients were really about, and if something is actually accurate in terms of its alignment and the dimensions of the pyramid. There's, you know, Peter Tompkins started with that a long, long time ago with pyramid power, and it's real. You can sharpen razor blades in there and all kinds of things.
Carmen, why Egypt? Why that location? For visitation, for teleportation? Why not some other region?
Well, if you look at the globe, the longest landmass and the widest landmass intersect right where the Great Pyramid is. And so it's the geodesic center of the world. And in the ancient times, it was the center of time. And it's the most stable place on the planet. So if you completely, you know, had floods and earthquakes and everything else, the way the pyramid is constructed, it was designed to withstand anything. And right now, I mean, it's been exposed to bombs and all kinds of things, and we don't have the technology to take them down, and they are as solid as can be, even though they've endured earthquakes and floods. So I think that's why.
Okay, next up we go to Cleveland, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Anna, it's your turn. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Thank you both for this fascinating discussion tonight. Lots to think about. I have two questions. The first one is a simple question. Across many cultures, in the depiction of the rulers and their people, they often depict the rulers as being very much larger, and we were always told in school that's because of their importance, but I was wondering if that would be related to the giants being rulers of the people. That's my first question. And my second question is about the race memory. And I used to have an experience when I looked at certain things. It was like a very strong deja vu. And I was wondering if your experience with the race memory ever came across as something like that, as a deja vu.
Absolutely. Well, that's the whole point of cellular memory is like deja vu. And when, you know, something's being explained away and it doesn't really fit with our cellular memory, there's a disturbing feeling. And that's basically what I've lived with my whole life. It's like there's something wrong here. I don't know what's wrong. I don't even know what's talking to me. And so, yes, when you get some kind of a memory that's triggering something of who you were before or what you knew before, there are very strong signals, and we've been trained to ignore them. Most people have incredibly accurate intuition. You know, take your umbrella. Well, the weather report says it's not going to rain, and so you don't take it, and then it rains. You know, we have to listen to our intuition and develop it like a muscle. But, yes, that's how cellular memory works. Larger, being more important, well, we tend to think of everything in terms of ego-driven patriarchal rulers, hierarchies, all that sort of thing. But perhaps the ancients were embedding the idea that of giants. But again, we've got to look at the dynasties and when things were created, because when you got down into the 20th, 22nd dynasty and all the Ramses, that really was ego-driven. Me, 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 me. I'm important. I am strong. And that's not what I'm talking about in terms of the high-level initiates that would have existed a long time before that. Does that answer your question, Anna?
Off we go now to Ontario, Canada. Hey, Mo on the international line. Go ahead, Mo.
Good morning, George, Carmen. How are you guys?
Good.
Riveting show tonight, like usual, George. And I'm God only knows how proud I am to be a Canadian like Carmen. I'm very proud of you as a Canadian, Carmen. My question is, queens and wives of pharaohs, during pregnancy, they go through some specific rituals. Would you please shed some light on that, and I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Well, it's interesting because Hakim, who was my mentor for a long time over there, who's now left us, and he's in the Pyramid Code, he says that even dynastic Egypt was matriarchal. And so that and Hatshepsut means the high house. And the ruler of the high house, the one who is up in front. And so it is true that the queens were revered. If you look at Nefertiti and Akhenaten's artifacts that came from the Amarna period, you'll see that Nefertiti was co-regent and she was honored at as much as the pharaoh. And I think that there really was more of that in some dynasties than has been exemplified through traditional Egyptology. And like I said before, the matrilineal line was the one that was followed. So it was always coming through the queen, through the daughter, and then the somebody that was coming outside the family would be brought into the matrilineal line, but always through the daughter. And so that was a ritual that was maintained even when Egypt was patriarchal. So was it really patriarchal? But it became more and more so as they went down through the dynasties.
We've got Maya in Denver, Colorado, west of the Rockies. Hey, Maya, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much, Carmen, for being on the show again. I don't have a question, but I wanted to share that I have had a lot of experiences of being in different lives, and I was starseeded here, and my memory is I was starseeded in the southwest in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in the southern tip of that, and then I grew in the mountain, in the tunnels in the mountains, with roots, and I was birthed out of the sacred blue lake above Taos Pueblo, and I was a giant, huge being. And I could straddle the lake, and I could walk over the mountains. And the information I received was that there are giants that are big light beings. They weren't all bad, like some of the shows have said. And also the reason there's not a lot of evidence of this is that we were much lighter, made of light. Our bones were so light that we were buoyant. We could fly them. And so I'm kind of shaking. So I just wanted to share that with you.
What time period, Maya?
I'm not really sure. It was eons ago, and I had other lifetimes after that. But what my experience was that Mother Earth had been invaded by dark intelligence or dark beings of different sizes, dark meaning not love, and she put out a call for help, and I was the one who came.
Thank you, Maya. You said that on the radio in front of a lot of people, and I feel strangely comforted by the fact that we're legitimizing these ideas somehow, because we've been told not to tell. And I'm particularly struck by the idea of the Sangre de Christos, the blood of Christ. Christ is the Christed one who was enlightened, who had 12-strand DNA. And Blue Lake, because Hakim says everything comes from the blue, from out of the blue. And so even that is a piece of the code. And thank you so much for sharing.
All right, very good. Thank you, Maya. And let's go next to Dan in Boston, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi, Carmen. Hi, George. How are you?
Good.
It's a great show. I wanted to I have two quick questions. One is, have you found any evidence of Atlantis in your research in Egypt? And also, are you aware that Mark Lehner, who's on the Egyptian Board of Antiquities there, actually wrote a book on the Edgar Cayce readings on Egypt?
Yes, two big questions. And Mark Lehner was publishing and involved in books with Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock. And then and he had to do with the Oriental Institute and the Giza Mapping Project and all of that. And then he went to Egypt, and all of a sudden he was given the second most prominent job in Egypt next to Zahi, which was the head of the so-called pyramid builders dig. And then all of a sudden he went radio silent on everything else. And so he started out being very involved in the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and all of a sudden he stopped with that work. And so I've always been curious about that. I don't know him personally, and I think that the two stories were diametrically opposed. So the Association for Research and Enlightenment carried on, of course, and they are, Edgar Cayce talked about Atlantis. Now, in the research that I've done, I've tried to stay away from what I call the A word, the alien Atlantis and angels, but it seems like the imperative to tell the story without those words is breaking down tonight. So I have not been on the air and ever spoken like this. So Atlantis. Again, I have past life memories from there, And we knew that the crystal was going to break apart and that the energetics were becoming off, that there was evil forces going on. And we needed to evacuate somehow. And some went off planet and some went and built pyramids all over the world. So I'm not saying that, you know, disembodied Atlanteans necessarily built the pyramids. I don't know that we need it to have been them, but it could be that they made a contribution to everywhere that there are pyramids on the planet.
Okay, great. Couple more minutes to go. Couple more callers as well. First time caller in Portland, Elisa. Hi, Elisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I have two quick questions. Regarding the vessels, which the gods use to transport from in and out of one dimension to another, do you think that that would have anything to do with what we refer to as mythology? And also regarding the giants, would that maybe be referred to as giants? And I want to know if what you have as far as evidence of Lemuria, because I have the past life memories of me and Lemurian, and we self-destructed before Atlantis sank.
Okay, Alicia, thank you. Well, I think mythology is a very good word because the concept is archetypal, that it exists in a frame of reference whether we know it's real or not. So Isis and Osiris are depicted as real people, but yet they could have been representing planetary systems. At Abydos, you see Isis is yellow-skinned and Osiris is blue-skinned, and then the populace who's on Earth is red-skinned. So do we know if they're real or not? Well, on an archetypal level, does it matter if they're real or not? And so it could very well be that the story's being told, but it's being misinterpreted. And so there's never going to be an answer. Mythology is almost like a dream, like which part's real, which part isn't, and what's actually going on. So it's a very rich concept. In terms of Lemuria, as I understand it, both Lemuria and Atlantis existed at the same time, though Lemuria started early and then Atlantis continued beyond. And there was a similar thing, but I don't think it was as violent in the end, and it was a much more feminine culture. And it may have had something to do with the Atlanteans imposing some of their energy systems that then destroyed the land. And as I understand it, some of the Lemurians went and lived in Atlantis after. And I have past life memories about that as well. So it definitely existed, and it was also known as Mu. And it's very, very ancient.
Carmen, I want to thank you for being on the program. Would you please give out your website?
It's pyramidcode.com. And may I also say that the Pyramid Code is going to be on TV on Documentary Channel starting on April 2nd, which is Good Friday for Five Fridays.
Super.
Yeah, it's going to be 30 million viewers.
You got
Well, potentially.
Potentially. Well, you'll get them. You'll get them. You do good work, Carmen. Thank you so much.
Thanks, George.
That's Carmen Bolter. She's been to Egypt 20-plus times. And each time she goes, she comes back with more incredible information. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.